Record it.
There we go. Tonight it is my great pleasure to welcome back Winnie Yu, one of the founders and owners of Tian's Fine Teas, one of the vendors from which we've been most happy to buy tea and sell it to Sebastopol and some kind of community for these many years. Winnie was born in Hong Kong and developed some of her knowledge and love of tea there, but when she came here to the United States, she discovered that there was a need, as well as an opportunity, to educate Americans about fine teas. And that has been her mission now for at least a little bit longer than we've been open, because I know that Tina's opened their Celadon Tea Room must be close to 7 years ago at this point,
something like that.
And because we actually went to an event there just a few months before, about a month before we opened our doors here in November of 2002. So, and I assume you were working on this project before that as well. I also want to recommend that she has some wonderful blog postings on the Tian's website about tea farmers, the life of the tea farmer in China, and many other related events. She's one of the founders of the Renaissance of Tea here in the U.S., and we're delighted to have her back with us. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, too. Are we okay with this level of brightness?
We can turn, maybe, I think we should turn that set off there. Yeah, that's fine. There we go.
I think I would have to say that it was more of a need than an opportunity, because I didn't realize how much work it would be. It was more that, you know, I couldn't get the kind of tea that I wanted to drink in this country, and I was fed up, you know. So every time I took a trip to Asia, which would be, you know, at least once a year, a couple of times a year, because really that's my second home, I would bring back suitcases full of tea. I mean, there'll be days when I come back and I go through customs and my wheels didn't move. You know, the wheels got kind of squashed because they were a little overweight. And then the customs officers would be like, well, why do you have so much tea in your suitcase? Why do you have nothing else? Are you in business? And that's when you think, I really should be in business. Why am I bringing so much tea back? You know, this is ridiculous. We can't find good tea in this country. So that was one of the reasons why this project started. And I have a lot of friends in my circle and community that are tea junkies like myself, tea fanatics or tea aficionados, tea connoisseurs, whatever you might want to call us. But really what we... what we're about is the world of artisan teas. When I say tea, people think of possibly chamomile mixed with lavender or, you know, some other concoctions thereof. And we don't think of tea as that definition. So nowadays we have to really make sure that people understand we're talking about artisan teas, like artisan cheese or wine. It's things that are specialty and handmade and really impart the love and the craft of the people who made them. Not something mechanized and made by a machine someplace, cut down by a lawnmower. You know, that's how 99% of the teas in the world are harvested, is by a machine with a lawnmower into a tea bag. Shall I go on? Swept up from the ground. But here is my latest favorite tea photo, which is great because I can take a lot of these photos on my own. I take one hand and I hold up a tea bud and I snap with the other hand. So this is how that photo came about as well. But this particular photo shows you the exact parts of the tea leaf that comprises of all five categories of tea. Okay, what are the five categories of tea? White tea, green tea, oolong, black tea, or we call it Hong Chao, which is red tea, and pu'er tea. Okay, those are the five categories of teas, right? So you see that little tippy bud there on the top? That's generally, technically, the white tea part, the part that makes the white tea. And then if you get the little bud plus the little premature leaf next to it, generally that's what you make green tea with. I say generally because some varietals are better suited for white tea making, some varietals are better suited for green tea. Some are better for oolong tea and not for green tea, etc. Okay? Technically also, if you were to get that large leaf with the bud and the purpura leaf, you get a nice oolong tea. Finally, if you get that much more mature leaf there on the bottom and you cut it up, you can make a black tea, or you can ferment it and make a pu'er tea. Okay, so this photo says it all. It's got all the parts. So I was just back from my spring harvest trip to Asia for the month of May. That's when the harvest usually occurs. Starting in April, it's usually April to May. And just to give you some perspective, that's kind of the actual size of these tea buds. And what does that tell you? They have to be picked by hand. Each one of these tea buds have to be picked by hand. So when you enjoy some of the fine green teas here and you wonder, well, are these leaves actually that big or did some machine chop it up? Hopefully here, all of the green teas, right, are intact whole leaf buds and they're generally that size. Okay, so imagine how many of these it would take to make a pound of tea leaves, dry tea leaves. You actually have to pick about 50,000 of these buds to make a pound of dry tea leaves.
How long does it take to pick 50,000 buds?
It depends on the field and it depends on the grade and the mountain. Some mountains are really steep, so it takes much longer. It might take someone might be able to pick half a pound a day. So about, you know, roughly 20 to 30,000 a day on some types of mountains. And some of them can possibly pick a pound a day, 50,000. Also depending on the speed of the tea harvesters and how skillful they are and how much experience they have. The older they are, the more experienced they are. So the 87-year-olds are really great. The 30-year-olds, not so good. So it has more to do with experience than stamina, I think. Anyway, so some of the green teas we just came in with is Lushan Clausimus. I think we have a batch, which is fabulous. And Taiping Ho Kui is a large leaf green tea. And but of course, you know, everyone... Do we have a dragon well here? I'm not sure.
Yep.
This is a picture of a dragon well, just from this trip. And never mind my hand, it's usually pretty dry and cracked, so don't worry about it.
What's different about that than some other leaf?
The dragon well?
Yeah. Could you tell it's a dragon well just by looking at it?
No, I can only tell it's a dragon well after it's been processed, because there's a style of processing. It's generally shaped into a very flat, yellowish type of shape and pressed by hand on a wok. But I can't tell from just this photo, for example, that this is a dragon well varietal, because there's about 5 different varietals that make dragon well. And you can also take those 5 varietals and make something else. So, but dragon well is one of the top historic green teas of China. And it's also one of the teas known for being a tribute or a taithe, as I would call it. The government would designate a certain amount of dragon well to be purchased every year as a state gift. And then the rest of us get what's left over. What's worse is that nowadays you have major corporations buying up the best teas and paying top dollar, because tea is a gift and that's always going to be part of the culture. And so merchants who, you know, bargain for price, and, you know, my sob story about the U.S. economy didn't go too far this year. I really need to get a price cut on this, because China's booming like you can't believe, so that story didn't go too far. There's a huge culture of tea in China, so we're going to see that more and more demand on this artisan tea is going to make it less available for people outside the country, because China has 1.7 billion people. And I think most of them drink tea. There's more and more Starbucks now, I'm seeing, but I'm not sure that many people go there yet. And tea houses like this is fairly common. Here's a beautiful 5-story structure tea house overlooking the West Lake. And you can see the willow trees sort of hanging and the bats zipping around. Yes, bats zipping around on the lake and with the sparrows. And typically you would sit down and order from a huge menu of teas, sort of like a wine list here. Yeah. So just these tea houses would demand most of the tea that's available in China, and let alone the fact that, you know, people drink tea all day long and they're giving these as gifts because they really represent a lot of prestige. So what should we do? Here's another example. This is a friend of mine who owns this enormous tea house. You know, you come to our shop and you're like, oh, that's pretty. It's a pretty big tea house, right? These are about 10 or 20 times bigger. And that's just one tea house. You can do everything there. You can, you know, get your own parlor, your own room, your own parlor. And you can use the buffet. The buffet's fabulous. Or you can just order tea with like 200 different snacks. You know, you can order from the menu. So tea culture is in very much demand in China and in Asia because people's standard of livings are increasing by quite a bit. This is another example. I'm showing you my travel photos to... A lot of people ask, you know, what are tea houses like in Asia? They haven't really been to one, and they don't know what it's like. It's very vibrant. It's always full of people. There's some people playing cards. You know, you can do anything you want. Behaving really well is not one of them. I don't think I let people play cards in my tea house, but I'm just kidding. Anyway, so this is just a view of some of the areas that this tea is grown in this very beautiful West Lake region called Hangzhou. So before further ado, if you have never had Dragon Well tea, please try some because it's very unique. It's in great demand. Unfortunately, its quality is not going to be as good from now on every single year. The quality will decline every year. So drink it while you can. Why is that? People ask. No one asked me yet. If you notice sort of the subtext behind all these photos, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of tea houses. The farms are actually really close to where these tea houses are. There are automobiles. There's, I think there's two Maserati shops. Let alone the other car shops. There's two Maserati shops in Hangzhou alone. Not to mention the Lamborghini shop and the other ones. And it's pretty prosperous, you know. And there's a huge amount of tourism, you know, because the lake is really beautiful. And, you know, you can go boat around there. It's a huge lake. The koi fish is about whale size. You know, you just you go there. It's a really big tourist attraction. The tea is just grown right outside the city. So what does that mean? More smog. To me, I don't look at it as a good thing. You know, it's more smog, more pollution. Therefore, each year the Dragon Well is not going to be as good as it used to be. So enjoy while you can. Be that as it may, I'm sorry I just killed the Dragon Well business. There's some really fabulous alternatives, like Lushan Clouds and Mist. And here's Phoenix Mountain, on the other hand, is so remote, so far away, not close to any pollution or any civilization, really. Well, it's sort of close to civilization. It's close to a little town full of people that drink tea every single day. There's about 20 tea shops per block. It's a really small little town. Everyone drinks tea constantly. So you have Phoenix Mountain being one of my favorite mountains because of its natural conditions conducive to growing tea. It's a very unique mountain in its soil quality. It's very red clay soil. And it's constantly foggy. So there's no pollution. There's no people, which is a good thing. And some of the most unique, and I think any of you come to the class last year when I was here, talk to me, Phoenix tea, yeah, it's one of my favorite teas. The leaves are harvested from these old trees, and the trees are typically 100 years old, 500 years old, okay? They grow very, very slowly because they're shrouded in this dense fog, so you get very little leaf every year. So if you're really lucky, you get about, you know, 5 kgs per tree, 5 kilos a tree is 10 pounds. Guess what? It's never going to make its way out of the mountain because just the locals would drink up all this tea. Each tree has its own unique fragrance. So the one that you know here has a honey fragrance. If you mix funny fragrance and honey together fast enough, you get funny. You have honey fragrance, almond, and pomelo as being some of the most unique and very striking fragrances. And then you have some that you're not so sure about. They call it like the 8 immortal fragrance. And you wonder, how did they get that name? I wonder what immortals smell like. They had one that was called the East is Red fragrance. That's a mouthful, right? It was called the East is Red because Chairman Mao visited Phoenix Mountain one year back in the 60s and decided that this is the greatest tea ever and, you know, name it after me. So it became the East is Red. So shortly after he died, they quickly renamed it back to its original name. So anyway, you have some of the most unique teas in the world here, grown in this mountain, cannot be grown anywhere else. In fact, you can't even grow these trees below the mountain. They don't survive. They have to grow at this elevation. And what is the elevation? About 1,340 meters. So that's roughly, is that 6,000 feet thereabouts?
A little over four.
A little over four, so almost 5,000 feet. Okay. On steep grades, generally, they grow on steep grades. And with these enormous root systems, the root systems are, I don't know if it's typical of trees in general, but the roots are deeper than the tree height. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they can grow to about 20 feet tall. That's just to give you some perspective as to you know, how teas can actually grow in the wild. Versus these bushes that you see in these nice manicured lawn-like pictures, you know, from elsewhere. And the artisans there, you know, they've been around. This artisan has a family genealogy of exactly 1,000 years. So his family's been there for many, many generations making tea, and they never really leave. And so, you know, every year they make batches of tea for the competition. And if you win a competition, that batch of tea gets to be sold at a certain auction price. So if this particular batch of Honey Phoenix wins, it's probably going to command about a $2,000 price for that 1 kilo. So 1 kilo is about 2.2 pounds, which is basically enough for them to live for a year. Yeah, so it's really important that they win the competition. And people would buy it. They would pay that price for it. There's definitely demand for it. So what does that mean? Well, competition is always good. It's like winning the Olympic gold medal and you get to be on Wheaties, right? You get a signing contract for $5 million. So they work really hard to perfect their craft and to keep their tradition. And so here you have, they have huge technology now. They have a little meter that tells them how hot. The lighting is a little difficult, but he's holding a bamboo basket, which is roasting his Phoenix tea. And below that is a charcoal pit. He's got little pieces of charcoal wood inside. He's carefully placed in the right places, so it's giving off the right heat. And now he's so advanced, he's got a little gauge that shows him that he's at 100 degrees Celsius. Whereas in the past, there's no way you could tell but just from experience, but you can't really tell how hot something is. You can't just turn the dial when you're doing charcoal fire. So they've kept a lot of their traditions over the years. Here's the guy tending his charcoal fire. Very complex process. You know, a lot of people wonder why tea isn't grown elsewhere. Why isn't it made in California? It's always a question. Part of it is the mountain elevations required and the soil, you know, et cetera. But also the artisanship is something that they've passed on from generation to generation. It's not something you can just learn. I mean, they start at 8 years old. They're apprentices until they're about 25. They don't really get good till they're 40 to 50. And then they usually, you know, by that age, good enough to go into some competitions. So really, it's a lifelong art, and so not something you can just go to school and get a certificate and say, I'm a tea master. So we've had just one of the best years in Phoenix tea. So be sure to try some. I think we can serve some today.
Yeah. In fact, should we start, or do you want to wait until after the initial part?
No, I'm going to do a fairly truncated talk today. So we can get to the tea, because I think people are more interested in tea than seeing my photos.
Oh, no.
Oh, good photos. Well, the indoor photos are not so great. A lot of the tea processing occurs at night. You know, imagine that you start harvesting during the day. You start at 9 o'clock. Hopefully the sun will be out by 12. The tea is really fussy in the way that you need really good fall cover and you need really good periods of sunlight. But you need the sunlight to be really short and really strong, and you need the fall cover to be really dense, really thick for a long time. It doesn't like rain, but it likes a lot of heavy moisture. Which means what? Well, the fall cover causes the leaves to be really drenchingly wet, so when you go harvest the leaves and it's wet, it's impossible to dry naturally. Plus, there's no sun to dry it with because it's foggy. Can you transport the leaves from one place to another to sun it and dry it? You know, let's say on the top of the mountain it's foggy, but maybe you can transport it to the bottom of the mountain. Well, that takes all day, so by the time it gets down there, it would have oxidized and wilted. So that would have ruined the lease. So you have to be able to sun it while you're on top of the mountain, but there's no sun. So what do? You can pray really hard. So you need there to be about sunlight right around 12 o'clock to dry the leaves naturally, and then you wilt it until about 4 o'clock, and then you take it indoors and you start the processing right away, and they go all night. Okay, it takes all night. The charcoal fire part of it takes 20 hours. So they're up. They're testing the tea every 15 minutes. So that 20 hours is a marathon. So I've been able to stay up for a little bit with them. It's pretty grueling.
And is that once per year that they do that, or is there a couple of different times where they'll go through that process?
That's about a 2 week to 3 week period, almost a month. Yeah.
20 hours a day for a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's one. That's
20 just, hours, yeah.
That's once a year that they do that.
There's two harvests with oolong teas. With the green teas, it's once a year. But with oolong teas, there's a spring harvest and a winter harvest, so twice a year.
Do they drink tea while this is going on?
Well, every 15 minutes they have to test the tea, so...
No, I mean, just as a chug-a-lug thing to do.
Yeah, they're testing their tea, so they're constantly drinking tea.
Everyone? Just the fresh tea they're drinking?
Right, so you're cooking your batch, basically. Okay. So you take some sample out, you're tasting it, and then you make adjustments. So that's every 15 minutes.
What kind of adjustments can they make besides taking it out of the fire?
The layer of the leaves get adjusted also. You know how much the pile is? They also shuffle it around. They adjust the temperature also. Some batches of leaves are, again, a little bit too wet. So they have to be able to sort through it really quickly, which is hard because... You know. So a lot of it is... most of it is just by feel. It's not very scientific. It's just art.
I work with people with wine tasting, and they just take a little bit. It's not like they chug it down.
Right.
That's what I meant. Do they just like taste a little, or is it?
They taste at least. Usually for these kind of things, they taste two infusions. So they infuse the leaves twice.
When they drink it, is it just a sip, a little bit?
It's a 3 ounce tasting cup.
So they take a good amount.
Yeah. Well, you can't really get drunk on the tea.
Right.
If you drink 3 ounces of wine per, that would be a little difficult. This is the finishing part of it. So after it's roasted, someone actually manually sorts and pulls out all the twigs, the twig part that's attached to the leaf. Mm-hmm. And so you only get the leaf because the twig dilutes your tea, your brew. So they have to sort it out. So everything is done by hand, basically. This is a picture of Mrs. Darius, our assistant manager at the shop. A lot of these mountains look kind of like this, where teas grow best. Full of fog, steep grades, lots of bamboo growing nearby, beautiful bamboo forest. Now, when you look at pictures of where teas are grown elsewhere that are commercial growing regions, flat lands, okay, no fog, lots of sun. The reason why is because tea actually grows really well in bright sunlight. Really well, but not good for drinking tea. Good for ornamental tea, flowers and leaves, bright green leaves. So places that have really huge plots of land that are flat, that are conducive to machine harvesting for lawnmowers to come through and cut through, that's where you don't have good drinking tea. Teas need to be distressed. They need to fight for sunlight in order for them to have this really rich brew. So the teas that are grown on flat, low-lying areas, which are good for commercial purposes, don't have the quality of high mountain teas.
You mean like Indian tea?
Some estates in India are fairly high, like Darjeeling is fairly high up there. But yes. But I'm talking more like, areas of Africa, for example. Mm. And I think they're growing tea now in... where are they growing tea?
Argentina
is definitely not quite as, So the soil conditions and the mountain conditions really matter quite a bit.
Is there just one community of census that they make tea from, or is there different species?
There's hundreds of species and thousands of subspecies. And all the different ways of processing. And each locale basically has its own variation. Some areas have you know, leaves like Phoenix Mountain, where the leaves are, not the right picture, where the leaves are fairly thick and fleshy, and they're really good for oolong teas. There are some areas that have really tiny little tea buds. Those are perfect for green teas. So each area has its own specialty. Anyway, really, you can't really see this. It's a little light, but you see this rich red soil there. So requires no fertilizer. Generally, these trees are sort of growing on their own in the wild. And people always ask, you know, these are organic teas. It's really tough to answer because USDA came along just how many years ago? And these things have been around for 1,000 years, so the trees are not going to worry about whether it's USDA certified. Hello. So anyway, it's hard to see here. Again, I've gone over this information already, but each of these trees have different fragrances, and we're not really sure why that occurs, but the honey fragrance is the most common and most successful fragrance. There are some that are just, no matter what they do, they could not produce another tree that has that fragrance. So, for example, there's one called the ginger flower. Again, this year, the top dollar went to that particular batch. I think it was like $6,000 for a kilo. But only 1 kilo was produced from the whole tree. So whoever has that particular tree really, you know, lucked out. Any questions on the Phoenix teas?
In terms of the, you know, you were saying that they wanted to get that period of bright sun to drip to dry the leaves at the right time. Is there, I mean, I'm wondering if they have a sort of traditional sensitivity to the climate there to know what a good day, and ahead of time what a good day, when that's going to happen or is likely to happen versus not likely to happen.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. They're really good at predicting the weather. Really, really, really good. I mean, I've been there on days where they'll tell me, we can't go up the mountain today. And I'll say, it's bright and sunny. What do you mean? We can't go up today. It's going to, you know, the density of the fog is going to be X, and there's no way we'll have like 3 feet of visibility. And I'll say, there is no way. It's so clear. And then sure enough, of course, I always try. or it's going to have a thunderstorm today. You know, they're really good at predicting the weather. In fact, like the Dragon Well, the pre-rain harvest has to occur 2 days to 3 days before the rain starts. And when it starts raining, it rains for a week or two. So what do? You have to pick your crop right before it starts to rain, because once it starts to rain again, you can't harvest. You have to wait. But while it's raining, the teas grow like crazy, so you don't get the fine little buds anymore. So you better pick it right before the rain. But when does the rain come? So they have to be able to predict. Every single year, for hundreds and thousands of years, they've been doing this.
So that's the monsoonal rain that comes in, more or less predictable, but they have to be able to sense the exact timing, is what you're saying.
Right. Well, the monsoon periods have different days, though. I mean, it's not like one continuous period.
Right.
So they have days. This year, actually, they said they were really fortunate. There was very little rain this year. So little rain, but lots of fog is good for tea. Because when you get a lot of rain, actually the tea tastes really diluted. It's like too much water in your tea. Yeah, it's really diluted. So they actually prefer less rain.
How do they deal with I'm not clear on this, that the black tea is a more mature tea, and the white tea is more tender, younger.
Mm-hmm.
How do they deal with that? If it's coming from the same, you know, you said that to get a black tea, it grows longer. Is that right? Am I understanding?
Well, imagine your hedges. You know, the new growth is the little tip tops on the top, right? The leaves on the bottom are always going to be older and fleshier.
Okay.
So generally, you don't want to waste the tip top leaves for black tea because you're just going to chop it up and make it oxidized anyway.
So the white tea, if you leave it alone, the white part will actually evolve into a black tea if you would just leave it alone.
You can technically pick the more, yes, you can technically wait until the buds become older leaves and then harvest the older leaves and make that into a black tea. And they have done that.
Uh-huh.
they pick, what they'll do is they'll harvest all the tips first, make that into white tea. All
right.
And then the sides, the side leaves, will keep growing. Those will become older leaves. And they will pick those and make that black tea.
And they always say that the black tea has more caffeine in it. Is that because it's more matured?
Generally, yes, because not because it's, yes, there's more, it's more mature, therefore it has more caffeine, but the main issue is that I always tell people this analogy: if you cut yourself, you're going to bleed. If you don't, your blood stays inside you. So black tea is chopped up leaf, basically. You have to oxidize it, you have to break the surface. Oolong teas are partially broken also to oxidize. So whenever you break the surface of something, everything flushes out, so the caffeine comes out much more easily in a black tea than a white or a green tea, which is basically intact. Make sense? Yeah. So our next stop was Taiwan. I always cover Taiwan because Taiwan has some of the best oolong teas in the world. In fact, all of the world competitions involving tea, generally the oolong category always goes to Taiwan. It's kind of like, you know, the Winter Olympics and the skiing always goes to the Netherlands or something, right? Does it? people in Taiwan only do oolongs. And people in Japan only do green teas. And China's got everything, because that's the mother of all teas, but and only black teas in India. So every area sort of has its own specialized variety. And Taiwan definitely specializes in oolong tea, and they're fanatical about how good their oolongs are. There's a lot of demand for the top grades, and in fact, the top grades sell the best. No one really wants the medium grades. For a while, there was a huge scandal in Taiwan. Huge. What was the scandal? Well, they had a president for 8 years that basically, you know, took the country for every dollar it's got, and now he's in jail. At least they're brave enough. they put him in jail like a week after he left office.
Wow.
They were pretty swift because he was so corrupt. But that wasn't the big scandal. The big scandal was that there were some unscrupulous producers who took the Taiwan varietals and planted it in Thailand or Vietnam for cheaper labor. And then they took those teas as Taiwan teas. Well, it's Taiwan varietal, so technically it's Taiwan tea, right? And they took it back to Taiwan and mixed it with the local Taiwanese tea and sold it. Boy, that was a big scandal. People were crazy for about a year and forced the government to restrict any more possible importation of any foreign tea because they have to keep their tea Taiwan tea. I would say, well, you should have been able to taste the fact that some of this wasn't even, you know, locally grown, but the merchants were pretty, you know, pretty smart. So they would mix, you know, for example, they would buy Baozhong tea from Wenshan, the area that it's supposed to be from, the source region, kind of like Champagne from Champagne, you know, and then mix it with some other teas. And, you know, if you judge from the fragrance and everything else, you can't really tell if you're not an expert.
They had the same scandal here in the festival. They were mixing oregano with medical marijuana.
Ah.
It was a big scandal. I mean, it was just outrageous. The town wouldn't stand for it.
Oh. Yeah, we've got to have the pure marijuana, right? Baozhong, one of my favorite oolongs. It's incredibly fragrant. It's not scented by anything. They would never dream of scenting it with anything. But it's this incredibly fragrant oolong that a lot of people would say, wow, was this scented with gardenia oil or jasmine oil, you know, et cetera? Actually, they were not. Okay. We only buy from, you know, source farms and places of origin. So where Baozhong is supposed to be grown, that's where we buy from. It's getting harder every year because there's so much demand, and literally I have to bribe them with a lot of different things. And one year it was chocolate, it didn't work out. Another year it was California wine, that didn't work out. It's like, gee, don't we have anything you want? So, but we're good friends, you know, the farmers and I. And that counts for a lot. They'll call me and say, well, listen, you know, I've sold my entire lot of Baozhong, but I'll keep 20 pounds for you. I'll be like, 20 pounds, that's 1 week's worth, you know. But anyway, these are Baozhong leaves, and they have to be obviously hand harvested. And they're relatively small leaves. And actually, this particular picture, you see there's a little bug bite. They're waiting for the bugs to come and chew off some of the astringency. So the tea's really, really sweet. So obviously, the next question is, obviously there's no pesticide. They actually want the bugs to come and bite off some of the leaves.
Is that the case of most Baozhongs? I know, like, Taiwan Beauty.
Taiwan Beauty is definitely that way.
Yeah. But are other Baozhong, are Baozhong?
He's actually making a Taiwan Beauty here. The Baozhong is the same crop. It's just a little bit earlier.
Bring
your lip balm. I forgot your lip balm. I just remembered. I knew I forgot something. I was coming out this way. We have this tea lip balm, and
it's very good.
Yeah, but it's perishable because it's freshly made, like everything else. So we didn't have any left. Taiwan Beauty is definitely a later harvest. That's because that's when certain kinds of bugs come.
Okay, so
because you want the right bugs.
It's a different time in the year when the bugs get.
Yeah. I know, it's like, what are we talking about? Bugs. When bugs come and when they don't. Well, you know how they always say that if you see bird bites in apples or pears or other kinds of fruits, it's an indication that it's safe for humans to consume, you know? And if it looks perfectly, you know, unbitten, that's probably a problem. If the bugs don't want it, he's actually making a Taiwan Beauty. Right here, it needs to be dried for 24 hours, so really pray for sun, because you can't have sun for 24 hours. There's a nighttime problem, right? But it needs to be air dry for 24 hours, so he's constantly spreading his leaves and re-spreading it and just kind of turning it over, you know, it's a lot of work. Mr. Lee's one of my favorite farmers. He's, you know, I love his story. He inherited one hillside. There's four brothers, and each inherited one hillside when their father passed away. Then his three brothers became engineers or whatever else that commanded a big salary and left him with the four hillsides. And then his kids are all going to school, and they don't want any hard work. I mean, they figured they can make lots of money doing computer work. So they don't need to be a farmer. So they've all left and gone to college or high school. So he's by himself tending four hillsides. So it's incredibly difficult. And the old family system used to be, you know, family and then 12 kids. I mean, parents and 12 kids. And then the 12 kids grow up and they each have 12 kids. So that's how the farms sustain themselves. Nowadays, people are having fewer kids, and also they don't want to work in a farm, even if it's tea. So I asked him, what are you going to do when you retire? He says, well, this is going to become a tea resort, you know. You can bring visitors in buses and come visit the tea. He loves what he does. I mean, every year I see him, he complains. You know, he says, boy, this is such hard work. You know, I almost got killed the other day because I didn't have help, and I almost fell down the mountain, and look at this big gash on my leg. And then he says, oh, by the way, I'm starting this new crop, and it's called Taiwan Beauty. You want to see this? And I'm thinking, why are you starting a whole new crop if you're really working so hard and, you know, it's really what they love to do. It's not because he's making so much money. And then he has to pan fire the tea on a wok by hand. And the wok gets to about 100 degrees Celsius, tossing the tea by hand. But, it's a beautiful mountain. He tried to, there's the harvesters. You know, you can see there's a lot of tea to harvest. And they all grow at the same time. And they will grow really large and not suitable for oolong tea very quickly if you don't harvest them. So you have to sort of be able to magically harvest all this tea all at once. How do you do that? Well, he's run out of farm hands. His kids won't help him. So he ended up going across the mountain and getting some of the older women from across the way to help him pick tea, and they're really good at what they do. Except he had to bribe them with like dim sum in the morning, and then this big elaborate lunch, and pick them up by car. And finally, one year he says, "I'm fed up. They're really surly, so I'm gonna get some workers from Indonesia." And they were the slowest harvesters he's ever found because they don't have the experience of having done it for 60 years. You know, I watched this gal pick tea one time. And I said, "Well, I'm faster than that." He says, how do I pay her? If I pay her by the pound, she's going to lose money. She picks like a pound a day. If I pay her by the hour, I'm going to lose money because that means I'll get less than a pound a day. So what do I do? So this year I saw that he let go of all his Indonesian workers and he's back to harvesting by himself.
There aren't workers in Taiwan that are willing to work like that. They have to import them from another country like we do.
We're importing workers from other countries.
Yes, we are. But I mean,
Taiwan is a pretty, you know, I mean, it was very well to do. Yeah, it's very affluent. I mean, it's run down now because of the 8 years of administration from this crazy president, but who spent all the money on arms. But before that, they were pretty prosperous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. China is going to have the same problem very soon.
They won't have people mm-hmm. who do the low-level work because they're getting too prosperous for
yep.
the 2 years.
It's going to happen very soon. So we have about maybe one more generation of hand-harvested teas.
And then those people with all that money won't have any tea to buy with all their money because nobody's out there making the tea. So there.
We don't have any tea. I figured, you know, maybe if we have tea for the next 30 years, I'm still going to be fairly happy. After that, I won't know anything. So. tea's great at fighting off Alzheimer's, by the way, I heard. the next stop for me after Wenchuan was the High Mountain, Sanlingxi. High Mountain is actually a designation. Anything over 800 meters is generally called High Mountain. This area, though, is about 1,600 to 2,000 meters. So definitely high enough to be called High Mountain, but when you hear High Mountain, it refers to Sanlingxi, which is the area. And again, as you can see, shrouded in total dense fog, and then on the sunny days you have harvesters out. The grades are pretty steep, so they're generally, you know, at least 45 degrees to be considered premium. But 60 degrees is pretty common. I have another picture other than this one that's really steep. I mean, when you look at it, it's almost vertical. And it's very scary because you can roll from top to bottom. I mean, there's nothing to catch you. So it's just all tea terraces. Be that as it may, if I'm even 1 week late in placing my order with some of these farmers, all the tea's gone. Okay, there's a huge amount of demand. Now, of course, you don't see the guy with the cigarette in the back, right? I tried to Photoshop it out, but I thought you should see how it is. These guys are making
straw.
Tea. It's a straw. It's not, you know, a cigarette. It's marijuana. Taiwan is technologically a little more advanced, so they actually have machines that could dry the tea much faster. Originally, they've had to do it by tumbling by hand. And so they're able to produce a slightly larger quantity, although their land area is really limited. Taiwan's an island, right? Has anyone been to Taiwan? Yeah. Now, this is my friend, Mrs. Sue. She still makes most of her tea by charcoal fire, which is the old traditional way, as I mentioned. But her charcoal is made with bamboo, the good Taiwanese bamboo. So she's really careful about how many sticks and where they're placed. And, you know, the whole thing is one... The charcoal firing itself is one level of artisanship, let alone the roasting of the tea and harvesting and everything else. All because they have the best competitions. Each locale has their own competition and they have nationwide. What happens in a competition, you submit a batch, about 20 kilos, and one small batch gets tasted. The judges get 1 kilo of the win, and then the rest gets auctioned. So you get your year's worth of revenue just from the competition itself. So now, do we only buy from the competition winners? Not really. Okay, we don't buy just because it's from a competition winner. I mean, we tend to purchase from certain areas that have the right soil and elevation. You know, 1 year, that lot might be better than this, and therefore it wins the competition, or it could be completely subjective. So a lot of it also has to do with friendship. You know, my friendship with particular farmers and people that I've seen over the years get better and better and better. I mean, our Baojong this year is fantastic. The Baojong farmer, Mr. Lee, is just getting better every year. And he does win a lot of awards. He does win a lot of competitions. it varies, you know, he's had first place wins and second place wins, third place wins, you know, over the years. But I wouldn't stop buying from him because this year he didn't win the first place. Mm-hmm. Plus, that would make it very prohibitive. Mm-hmm. It's about, I think it's $900 US for a pound of Baojun for the first place winner. Mm-hmm. Not bad, right? So, you know, those are some of the driving factors for people to hone their craft and get better and better. And, you know, a couple things, the demand for the best teas and the prestige and the rewards that go into making these teas. So tea is very important to these cultures in Asia, in China and Taiwan and Japan. I didn't go to Japan this year, but last year one of the farmers won the Gilcro farmer won the Emperor's Cup for the Gilcro. The Emperor's Cup is really prestigious. It was explained to me, I don't know if it's true, that it's like the award that covers all things. So the Emperor could decide that this year's winner would be a great car design or shoes or architecture. But then, you know, last year it was the tea, and he was the winner. So definitely very prestigious and important. And so, do we have something like this here? Not for tea. I don't think tea's quite, you know, grabbed the position of prestige that other beverages like wine has yet. And in Asia, the connoisseurship is no different. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah. I forgot the tea you mentioned.
Did
that help with Alzheimer's?
I think I forgot. I forgot what tea that was. Actually, I was told, I'm not a medical researcher, that pretty much all teas would have that effect. But the fresher and usually the greener the tea generally retains more of the nutrients and benefits. Except for pu'er, which is fermented and has its own benefits. But you wouldn't want to drink a green tea that's 2 years old. You want to drink it fresh, new harvest. Generally, the white and green teas are attributed with the best health benefits.
When you said that in Taiwan, the top teas were most popular and the grades weren't, is that the level that these medicinal cures are found, these top grades?
I don't know that to be a fact. I don't know that to be a fact. Generally, the top grades are associated with being produced and harvested from the best conditions to render it the best quality. So the highest mountain, the best growing conditions, right? Which, whatever that makes it taste good, is also nutrient-rich.
Is there teas that deal with...
Let me just interrupt for just a second. I'm just going to, as you guys are chatting, I'm going to just show a couple of the teas that we're going to taste right now. One is... this lovely Taiping Ho Kui, is that
mm-hmm. It's one of the greens. I didn't cover that yet.
Right, and it's a very distinctive leaf. You'll see it looks very different than this particular leaf, which is the Maojiang hair tip. So I'll just be passing this around as you guys are.
Now, Maojiang is a hair tip tea. I didn't cover that. It's made from really tiny little buds that's been rolled into as close as possible to resemble a strand of hair. Mm-hmm.
Teas that deal with blood pressure, arthritis, and cholesterol problems?
Generally, people think that the pu'er tea is best for that. The fermented teas, pu'er.
Pu'er.
Rob, do we have some pu'er here? We can.
We do.
Yeah.
We can
recommend.
You.
We'll see what Rob has.
We have one of your...
Tibetan mushroom? The Tibetan mushroom is a kind of pu'er, so any pu'er would probably be good. But the naturally fermented aged ones are better because it's...
Fermented pu'ers.
Yeah. Pu'ers. Yeah.
But you're saying the naturally aged ones are the ones that are start green and then basically just are oxidized or not accelerated?
Right, not accelerated by artificial humidity, but naturally aged over their true period of time. So be it 5 years or 15 years. However long it takes.
This is your 5 year, actually.
Our pours, if They've been aged naturally for 5 years, 15 years, whatever it is. It's naturally
this
aged.
This particular one.
Otherwise,
is a 5 year one.
They're not billed as, you know, aged. They're just fermented.
5 years is the minimum for.
5 years is really for us is the minimum. I mean, otherwise they're the artificially aged ones that are
no,
1 year.
That, that aged one is a dark pu'er, right?
Yes.
Do you have?
Well, it turns dark when it ages because the green pu'er is not dark because it's not aged.
So what's the right terminology for it? I guess it's cooked versus uncooked.
Yeah, or just post fermented versus non fermented.
So is this particular one cooked or uncooked?
Uncooked. It's naturally aged.
What is
I know, it's
called?
Really, that takes a whole class. You know, yeah. The poor. It's very complicated.
I mean,
Rob, what's
I don't know
title
it's
on
like
that
composting,
one?
Right? The cooking is like
not your
oh, just
in the artificial environment.
Simple,
yes, it's like
simple
composting.
For us.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right
there. I'll take all of that.
Yeah, we could do a poor class. That's one of my favorite subjects. Yeah, I generally don't do it during spring harvest time because it's. It's been around for a while. It will stay that way
so
for a while.
It's not going anywhere.
Although I used to have a 40-year pour, it definitely went someplace because we don't have it anymore. It got drunk. Everyone drank it up.
What would be a typical garden practice for the year in a plantation?
Garden practice? Meaning how do they maintain their... The hillside.
Uh-huh.
Depends on the mountain.
So
I mean, some mountains are really cold, so before the harvest in the spring and the winter, they have to keep it warm, keep all the plants warm. Mostly, they just graft or they do a clipping, cutting,
uh-huh.
by about June, depending on whether they plan to harvest in June to July or not. So again, it depends a lot on where it's grown. And what the purpose is, because if certain growth areas are intended for, let's say, commercial teas, they're going to harvest all year. So the maintenance of that is going to be very different from some of these teas. And then the Phoenix Mountain teas, nothing happens. They're pretty much wild.
Amend the soil or add anything? Or just
nope, the soil's really rich. They don't do anything to it.
Hmm.
It's like wild crafting. Yeah, the tea just sort of lives there. So, I mean, sometimes they do a little pruning. Occasionally, they'll do some grafting. If they saw that one particular tree is getting really weak, they'll try to save it by clipping and then grafting it to a stronger tree with a better root system. And then, so they try to save that tree that way. Some of these trees, a bunch of the 400-year-olds died, you know, in the last because of climate change. Global warming, you know, et cetera, so a bunch of them died. So they try to save those trees by grafting, but not very successful. Yeah. And there's also, you know, environmental problems. One of the hillsides is full of plastic waste, for example, the Phoenix Mountain. And the farmers have never had plastic in their lives. They don't understand plastic. They don't know what plastic is. They don't understand that plastic doesn't really decompose the way that their watermelon seeds would decompose, you know. So they just have this trash pile in one designated area of the mountain, and they put all their trash there, animal feeds or chicken bones or vegetable waste, and you know, it's like their compost, except they didn't understand the plastic doesn't really compost with everything else. And so it's just like piles and piles of plastic there, and I can't get them to understand what's going on. So yeah, it's sad because it's traditional culture meeting modern culture, and they don't really. And I said, don't you have a garbage truck that comes up and collects all this plastic stuff? She said, nobody comes up the mountain. What do you mean? So
is Taiwan less polluted than China, or less less in danger of the tea industry being adversely affected by pollution, air pollution?
That's difficult to say because it depends on the mountain. You know, in China there are a lot of really remote mountains like Phoenix Mountain. Actually, like Lushan, for example, is in the middle of absolutely nowhere. You can find smog if you know, you wouldn't think it's the same country, you know. Whereas you go to places like Shanghai, anything near Shanghai is just polluted. So Hangzhou is about an hour away from Shanghai, which is where the Dragon Well is. This particular one, yes, made to look like hair. So imagine how difficult that is to make. This is about as fresh as you can taste a green tea outside of the farm because it was air freighted. A lot of the China's fortune that's got huge geography. So even though many cities are overdeveloped and very, very polluted, like Beijing and Shanghai, those are not near the tea mountains in general. The only teas that are grown anywhere near the cities are teas like Dragon Well. Most of them, the best teas, are grown on very, very high mountains, and it actually takes all day to get in. And some of them are barely, I don't want to say civilized, but modern enough to have electric. Generally, factories and industries are nowhere near these mountains because it doesn't make sense. They can't put a power plant up in the top of the mountain, and there's not enough power. And going up these little narrow hairpin, you know, mountain passages to put your factory up there is not going to happen. So very little industrialization happens in mountains, and that's why we always buy from high mountains. Not to mention that's where the teas grow best. Commercialized teas, on the other hand, are grown on the bottom of the mountain. Lots of yield, lots of pollution. So we don't buy those. If there's anything that I care to carry, I mean, I have to be able to want to drink myself, so.
Is there a wrong way to cook, prepare tea?
Wrong way?
Yeah, like what I've been doing it, let's say I'm doing it wrong. I put a cup of water in my microwave and I for about 5 minutes.
The way you're telling me, you're always telling me that you're doing it wrong.
It's just the water boiling, very hot, and then I pour it into one of those porcelain presses.
Well, let me talk about the microwave part. No, I'm just kidding. I don't actually even own a microwave myself.
Oh, okay.
I prefer no microwaving of anything. There's a lot of reasons for that. So, but, well, the electromagnetic waves would be one, you know. Whatever that can cook your food can probably cook you as well, but it's just not, it's over a period of time. I find that the water tastes best if you just let it boil on its own. You can use electric, you know, those hot water dispensers that cook on their own, or you can just put it over a stove.
What about one of those coils that you plug in and drop it? I have one of those.
Yeah, even those are preferable to microwave. I think those are okay. You can just heat it up.
Can you use tea leaves over, like you press it, and
this
you
is
do it another?
You can reinfuse 4 to 5 times for most premium teas, yes. And certain oolong teas, you can get about 8 infusions.
Taiping.
Well, imagine these are whole leaf teas. So over time, you steep the leaves, they unfurl slowly.
This is the one with the bigger leaves, though.
The proper pronunciation is Taiping Hokui.
Mm-hmm. It's named after a town.
So
yes.
You put the tea in a press, like a measured amount. You can use it up to 4 or 5, up to even 8 times.
Uh-huh.
What tea is that? A high grade tea that would do that?
Well, all of the teas that, the white and green teas that we provide generally will yield at least 4 to 5 infusions. So you steep it once, and then you steep again, and you steep again. So 4 or 5 infusions. The oolong teas generally take can take up to 6 to 8 infusions. Pu'er teas can go as far as 10 infusions or more. The Phoenix oolong, here's my favorite part, can take up to 20 infusions. Yeah. I've counted it. That's really good for business, but that's you run through your tea really fast.
They told me in his story here, but when I put that hot water in the tea leaves, I let it sit there to get some room temperature, and then I put it back in the microwave again with the tea to heat the heat. So when I'm letting it sit there for, I think, 10 minutes, maybe, is that damaging or something?
Well, rather than address what is wrong, I think that we should, I'll send you some guidelines on how to steep tea. You know, so maybe you can or Rob can send you some final, yeah, because there's some steeping instructions. So forget about what you've been doing. We'll start from scratch.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And
I'm doing it all wrong.
That's right.
Start from scratch, and then you're gonna find that your tea tastes so much better. It'll taste a lot like this. And then you can really enjoy the tea as it's meant to be consumed. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole art and culture of tea preparation. You've heard the tea ceremony. That's one aspect of it. But we have many ceremonies, but a lot of it involves how to get the best cup of tea possible. Because unlike wine, you know, with wine, well, it's a great bottle of wine, so you have nothing to do with it. You open it and you enjoy it. But with tea, you have to have a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of skill. You don't need a lot just to enjoy your cup of tea, but with a little bit of knowledge, you really could enjoy it to the degree that the tea master wanted you to enjoy it, because he put all his heart and all his effort into making that batch of tea. Then, hopefully, you wouldn't butcher it. You would actually prepare it the way that it should be prepared, and then you can really enjoy what he intended.
But you went on these tours, this journey went on. Did you see tea preparation specialized that you could share with us?
Each tea requires a slightly different preparation technique. But I would say that generally the guideline is steeping no more than a minute for your batch of
a minute
for each infusion. And if you follow the guidelines on the amount of leaf to the amount of water, you should steep each infusion for about a minute. In the old days, you know, the British were steeping tea for 5-10 minutes. They didn't really get the steeping instructions, I think. It was all in Chinese. Nobody bothered to translate it. So it was five. And they said, oh my gosh, this is so bitter. How can we drink this? Let's add some cream and sugar. So that's how everything started that way. But actually, you're not supposed to steep it for 10 minutes.
This is the Baozhang we're drinking now. Everyone.
Oh, my favorite. Just feel the fragrance linger in your throat.
Does all the Taiwan beauty come from Mr. Lee?
No. Most Taiwan beauty is from the middle of the country, and it's made from the other oolong varietals. He's the only one that's making a Taiwan beauty from the Baozhang varietal, because that's what he grows. Yeah.
So if you buy something here that says Taiwan beauty, you don't know that it was the Baozhang varietal.
It's usually not.
Anything that would be eaten by the bugs, the leafhoppers.
Well, they have to be generally oxidized by leafhopper to qualify as a Taiwan beauty. But it could be a different varietal of tea plant.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, in the past years, we've had Taiwan beauty from other oolongs, like Jinshuan or some other oolongs. But ever since Mr. Lee started making, this is the first successful year. He's only done it for a couple of years. Last year, we bought his 2 kilos that he made. And this year we bought 20 of the 30 kilos that he made. The Baozhang Taiwan Beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see. Mm-hmm.
And I'll send you guys some samples. It's fantastic. Yeah, I had a batch that I sampled last week. And so he's making it from his Baozhang, because that's what he grows. And it just turned out to be phenomenal. You know, no one's ever made it out of Baozhang before. Mm.
What's it usually made out of?
The other oolongs, like Jinshuan. Yeah, the other Taiwanese oolongs. So it's just a lot sweeter, because the Baozhang is really sweet.
It's Baozhang, it's so lovely.
Yeah, we've had. So back to the pollution problem, is Taiwan more polluted, less polluted? China has the geographic advantage of having some really remote high mountains.
Okay, so you can get it in unpolluted areas.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, that's what we're all about, and definitely not pollution. Taiwan, the mountains are in pretty good condition, but still it's a smaller island. Mm-hmm. So
you can't get that remote.
You can't, you know, although I was at Lishan this year, so I'm going to talk about that next week. Lishan is at the other side of the island, and it's 2,700 meters up. I mean, there is absolutely, it's so hard to even get there. There's absolutely no pollution or anything close by. I mean, they just had a road built. They did. It was like, it's so scary. They have these tunnels. Literally, you could tell they just blasted it through. And it's just car width, right? So, and there's no lights. So you're driving through, huh? Of course not. So there's no put lights, you know, no lights. So you drive through these caves to go through these mountains, and it's like, I'll see you in this cave. It's really kind of scary, you know, pitch dark and just driving through. And you come out and you're on a cliff, you know, and it's just like, and then it's blinding fog, you know, and then it's rolling boulders, right? Because we just had some rain and earthquake, so the boulders are coming down.
Oh my goodness.
Speaking of earthquakes, you ever hear
you
cold?
You have to be very brave to go there.
Did you ever hear from the people that you deal with? High mountains?
Yeah, the farmers are okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. I don't really have friends there except farmers, so.
Yeah.
So they're okay. The Ermeshan is okay. Yeah, we got some really good bamboo green issue.
What we're tasting now is Cold Summit Dongding.
Cold Summit Dongding was made from the woman tea maker.
This is the high mountains.
She's really, really.
Okay.
Isn't that great?
This is the one she was talking about. Phoenix.
Taiwan tea has its own distinct character. Really floral without.
There's two different styles.
Of it's floral in the tongue, it's not, you know, in the nose.
Honey water or more.
Yeah.
Sometimes,
like, some of the best thing about the tea is the aftertaste.
It's not, this isn't the one.
The aftertaste is one of the criteria for judging, so definitely. You know, how it tastes, how it lingers, what that feels like in your throat and your palate. Tea is a mild stimulant for your nervous system, so generally it's good for memory and alertness and possibly Alzheimer's. Yeah. I'll find out. The amount of tea I drink, I think I'll be a good poster person for, did she get Alzheimer's or not? We're going to be, you know. Well, thank you guys. That's really speedy. It's really fast.
Now we're brewing hot.
Wow.
These are nice teas.
They're very nice teas.
Next is the High Mountain Light Roast.
So the High Mountain Light Roast is what elevation did we get it this year? It was 1,700 meters. Still pretty high.
Is it considered sacrilegious to put honey and sugar and lemon juice in teas to alter flavors, maybe raspberries and things like that?
You could do those to the lower grade teas, but generally not this level. Yeah, these are artisan teas. It's sort of like, that would be a good analogy.
Lipton tea would be.
Lipton tea would be very appropriate, yeah.
Making a wine cooler out of Chateau Lafite.
Yeah,
really
okay, there you go.
Yeah, you wouldn't do that, yeah.
Yeah, that would be kind of like...
I have a friend who decided her white wine was too cold, so she put it in my cooler. I just about died.
Wow. That's a good one.
Yeah. It's just too cold. It just came out of the fridge. It's way too cold. So.
I think warm white wine is a little...
Yeah.
A little disgusting.
Yeah. Like, when you put the cubes in red wine, it's the same crap. So. It's not unclear on the concept.
Do people ever brew teas in cool water? I've heard Dragon Well can be like brewed for like half hour in a water that's at room temperature. But I was wondering if people do that, or is that just a peculiarity of...
No, it will extract. You know, the teas will extract in cold water. In fact, that's how we make our lychee red at the store, is by cold brewing.
Yeah.
You know, you put your tea. What they do in Japan sometimes is they put their sencha on ice cubes and let the ice cubes melt, and it steeps the tea at the same time. It just takes, like, you know, 2 hours.
Mm, interesting.
There's actually a cold brew gyokuro now. Mm-hmm. It's really delicious.
Yeah. So you can do that. It's a different... You get a different profile of the tea,
right,
from the hot tea.
We've noticed that with black teas in particular, we started recommending people brew at lower temperature because it comes out sweeter.
Yeah, definitely.
And in fact, it's such a, you know, we kind of backed into this because of limited temperature variations on our water heaters. But
right.
It's like we've done tastings of high temperature and low temperature, and the low temperature is much closer.
Right. You know, we don't really have to boil our water anymore. Our water's drinkable.
Yeah.
So those days are over. It used to be, you know, put the kettle on, let it boil, and boil the water, boil it until it's totally flat. But all the bacteria is killed, and then, you know, steep your tea, but really that's not necessary.
Well, I think, yeah, I've got the impression that the boiling of tea is kind of a holdover from the British tradition when they probably had pretty bad quality tea. You need to boil it and put a lot of sugar and milk in to just, you know.
They boil the water for it to be drinkable, so that's number one. So we don't have to do that now. But, you know, folks, the best thing to do is get one of those kettles. They're great. You know, if you drink tea on a day-to-day basis, get one of those kettles.
It
boils really fast. No, even those ones that plug in, that has the electric plug.
There's a couple different kinds.
Yeah, these ones boil really fast.
These are nice ones. They're temperature regulator. Then the Zojirushis are kind of a Cadillac of the water heaters.
Right.
We've had these, actually, the Zojirushis that we've had and that we're using tonight have been in the store since we opened, and they, you know, they're still like new.
Right.
We tried a cheaper brand that kind of died after 2 years, and these have been.
That's a Japanese brand. It's the Elephant brand. They'll last forever, literally. Not that that's, you know, I'm sure they want you to buy a new one every couple of years.
Well, they came out with a model that has an insulated jacket, so if you want a green hot water heater,
that's what we got.
Yeah.
It works beautifully.
Just to tell you guys, another reason why I have a store is because there's a machine made from FETCO. It's, you know, the industrial model, and it runs 20 gallons at a time, but it's plugged into the infrastructure, so it's always refilling itself with water. I never have to refill it. It's constantly refilling itself because I can probably run through 20 gallons, you know, if I'm in a store. So it constantly feeds water, and it heats up really fast. It brings it up to the right temperature, and I have two machines with two varying temperatures. Mm-hmm. So,
what water do you use? You use filtered.
I have a Japanese filter called Everpure. It's really good.
Yeah, that's great. The honey water remodel is.
This is the honey water remodel.
Absolutely outstanding.
Okay.
These are 50 to 100 year old trees. So they're considered relatively young, but it's the only varietal that we can actually get in quantity for.
I'm still amazed you can get this quality handmade tea for the price. Like, the price seems like dirt cheap compared to it. It looks like the quality of what you're getting.
Exactly. If you compare each cup and what you're paying for each cup of tea, how many infusions you're getting versus the stuff that you get in a tea bag, you know, you compare that cost. It's shameful. I mean, why wouldn't you support these artisans that are making these things handcrafted at this price when you're just paying maybe a couple of dollars more than machine-made, low-grade tea bags? Really, that's what we're talking about here. You know? So that's one of the reasons why I like showing slides, showing the people that made the tea. You know, you connect to, oh, these are real people making these things, you know.
I love the story, just the fact that there's people, particularly the Phoenix Mountain, his family have been doing this for 1,000 years. It's like that kind of knowledge, and that even makes, like, the wine industry look young.
Kind of young, right? Well, that's 1,000 years. The poor stuff is, like, a couple thousand. I mean, they have,
and
you know.
It's amazing, because there's the... You get the benefit of that. You get the benefit of that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, it's a matter of, you know, because I'm bicultural, so I'm in a position to be able to translate and impart some of this information. I mean, this is not my information. Mm-hmm. This is information that exists and has existed for thousands of years. And I'm just translating and letting people know, hey, this is accessible now. The countries are getting closer because we have better transportation.
That's
that? Yeah, this FedEx.
Much FedEx, right?
FedEx,
get your tea flown right over. Right?
Yeah.
So do you think that the tea production, like in a place like Phoenix Mountain, do you just see that dying out because of modernization, or do you think that the society is going to keep an allowance for that?
Phoenix Mountain is in a very good advantage that they are surrounded by absolute tea fanatics. People there drink so much tea. That's the only town nearby in the country that I've been to, in China, that I don't see any growth. There's no high rises. There's no increased number of automobiles. There's no modernization almost. People spend all their money on tea.
Whoa.
So
basically,
there's no Lamborghini shops. They spend all their money on tea. There's a lot of tea shops everywhere, and people spend all their time, you know, talking about tea. So they will buy everything that Phoenix Mountain has to produce. Yeah. So this tea, you know, it rarely leaves the country. Sometimes you'll see Phoenix Mountain tea somewhere, and I taste it and I said, this is not from Phoenix Mountain. I'm very aware of what Phoenix Mountain tea tastes like. So. It rarely leaves the country, or its locale.
This is the second infusion of the
mountain. Has a really nice buttery consistency.
This infusion is nice. It's a little fuller bodied in it, and the sweetness and the smoothness really comes through.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you drink this green tea bags? You know? The worst tasting green tea I've ever had was that decaf green tea. It was the worst.
Anyone who comes into the shop and says, oh, I don't like green tea, I say, you've been drinking tea bags. That was
And
the worst.
Putting it in boiling water and letting it sit for 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It's
pretty yucky. Pretty bad.
When I do business travel, it's usually when I drink coffee because I can't get good tea on the road. I'll take some with me usually, but when I'm here, I'll drink tea all the time. So I'm spoiled. I've been ruined.
I know that when we traveled to Australia, that one of the joys was in the room, they don't have a coffee maker. They have a hot water machine in each room.
Yeah.
And then you can either make coffee or tea or whatever. So there was no running to the restaurant or the bar to get hot water.
Right.
Which was nice.
And no carafes.
And no carafes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
The Baojiang was nice. Maojiang is nice. This is Maojiang.
Maojian.
Hair tip.
Mao's hair.
That's one that we haven't carried before, so we're sampling it to.
Very nice.
Very good.
Audience response.
The Lushan is one we've carried. That one, I love that one.
Yeah, Lushan is one of the most unique green teas there is. You just can't find anything close to it.
How do they do the, what process do they do to get that like sparrow tongue, that tiny?
The tiny curls, the spirals are actually easiest, I was told to make. It doesn't look easy to me, but the hair tip shapes are one of the hardest.
Because it's long.
Yeah, you have to shape it so it's, but the spiral shapes just take twisting like this on a walk by hand. It's just Stuart. It's just, you know, this motion here.
Just kind of rolling it.
Right. One of the teas I'm going to cover next week is actually tomorrow. It's called the rainflower tea. It's really rare, and the leaves have to resemble pine needles. So most of us don't know what a pine needle looks like. We can imagine hair, but what does a pine needle look like? Well, it's beyond just a hair. It has to be hair shape and thinness, but it has to start with a little round end, and it has to taper off into a tip. So it's like a pointy tip. So it has to start round, taper off, and then one of the edges has to be a knife edge. Okay, now how do you shape a little tea leaf into that shape? So only 10 artisans know how to make that in the country. So, which means the world, because who else in the world knows how to make this? Yeah. So that's.
Is there? Do you see that there are young people today who do show interest in the tea? Is that rare? Is that
some farms? Yes, you know, some farms have. You see some young people that have come back from university and became interested in their tea tradition. They find that being an engineer is not really all that's cut out to be.
And I'm wondering if there's a sort of an analogy that in this country, you know, people often the children in the family will, like, if they're a wine family, they'll go to Davis and, you know, get a viticulture degree and then come back and support, you know, the family business. And I wonder if there's anything similar with tea, where there's investments in technology, investments in bringing the business more modernized.
In certain areas.
Yeah.
So it depends on the mountain again and how forward they are. How much demand for their tea, or how much you can actually expect to make You know, so for very prestigious mountains where there's a set demand for their tea, yeah, there's a little more of that. For some, because the mountain's really small and you can only make so much tea per year, and even if you sold every single leaf you have, you're still only going to make this much money. You know, so that's the way it is. So yes and no. You know, there's some instances where it's coming back.
This is second infusion Baozhang now.
But I think everything sort of has that cycle. You know, you go through a period of time where no one's interested in it, and then all of a sudden people come back to it and say, oh, okay, this is our treasure. I mean, for example, China alone had a hiatus of about 50 years of no tea.
None?
Just because
you know those tea houses?
You mean no like, exports?
No exports, but no, all the tea houses were shut down.
They were bourgeois or something?
Yeah, they were bourgeois.
Oh,
the tea consumption was bourgeois. So the farmers just made whatever tea they could make for themselves, and that's it. And some of them ended up just leaving their fields to waste, you know, because they couldn't sell the tea anywhere. You weren't allowed to really sell your tea. And there are no tea houses that are going to serve the tea, so they shut everything down.
Here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
communism, so.
Yeah.
This tea house was shut down. This is a new one. Tea houses like this were
the
epitome of
bourgeois.
I would say the early 90s, when Deng Xiaoping came around. You know, the late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, it was about 50 years, from 1950 to about, 90s, so 40-ish years.
But if Chairman Mao came to the mountains and wanted tea named after him, you'd think that the tea was okay.
Well, those are taif teas. That's different.
Those are what?
Taif teas, or
tribute
teas. They were for him. That's different.
Oh, but not for the common man couldn't have them.
No.
Oh, well, that's right.
I mean, if for anyone who thought that communism meant one class system, think again. I don't want to start my political views here, but it's most definitely not the case.
You know, the movie, the novel Animal Farm, which was a parody on communism,
right,
all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yep.
Yeah, that's much like that.
Exactly that way.
He could have his own tea, but nobody else.
That's it. It's still sort of true today because the best teas do go to the government.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So from every level. So you have the central government, then you have the provincial, and then you have the local, and you have the city, and then you have the... They're all just sort of like bandits, you know. They take whatever they want.
Speaking of which, someone should note that today is a very important day.
Today is a very important day.
Oh, the 20th anniversary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Tiananmen
Square.
You were there 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Actually, no, we were back here by then. We were in Tiananmen Square in the middle of the demonstration.
Well, this one I'm not sure.
That was the day that my sister-in-law actually went to Beijing University, so she was there.
Yeah.
So she, quite a few of her classmates were, you know, made into jam. You know, so she never saw them again. She wasn't there protesting. She just went that day to look or whatever she was doing, taking photos. And she said, wow, she's just so infuriating that they would still deny that it actually happened, or they would say, oh, it didn't actually happen. You know, I mean, it was all, where are all these footages from? Not to mention real eyewitnesses.
But they were barring journalists from going into Tiananmen Square today. They were checking their credentials and making sure they... Well,
they were shutting down Twitter and Facebook and all those things because they didn't want anybody...
Well, they shut the blog when I was in China. Yeah, they shut the Blogspot, Blogger, and TypePad.
And meanwhile, in Victoria Park in Hong Kong, 150,000 people had light visuals.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
That'll get them in trouble for about a year.
Yeah.
Hong Kong's had it good for... for a while.
Yeah.
The people in Hong Kong are not very politically minded. They generally don't do anything political.
That's the one thing that they've done every year.
Thing they do every year. Yep.
Because I know we left China on May 31st. And, you know, we got home and you're just barely getting acclimated. You turn on the news or whatever, and it was just we were shocked, because we knew that's what was going to be the ultimate outcome. Even when we were in tandems, we're talking to the students, they knew that was what was going to happen.
Right.
And when we left Beijing, we saw the army bivouacked on the way to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so you knew it was going to happen.
Getting it out.
Ready.
What is this?
Honey water.
Yeah. Is there any?
What was the one we just had?
The one we just had was the.
Is there English influence?
Yeah, are they still active?
There's still a lot of expats that live in Hong Kong. Yeah.
Thank you.
No. Nothing like that. No. No. They're still around. There's still quite a.
Is there a strong feeling of Hong Kong and the rest of China? Is that
absolutely. Absolutely. It's like night and day. Hong Kong is one of my favorite places on earth because it's probably one of the most efficiently run cities.
You still have family there?
Yeah, I still have family there. It's very efficient. I mean, it's for the population and the size, you can get around without a hitch.
Well, because the British, right?
Are the British really efficient? I don't know.
I don't know. They Europeanized Hong Kong.
Well, Hong Kong, the people in Hong Kong are really into efficiency, so they count money really fast. The banking system is impeccable. Transportation system is impeccable. Mm-hmm. You even have elevators in certain places to go on street level to get from place to place.
Would it be more comparable to Singapore, maybe, in terms of efficiency?
Mm-hmm. It's even more efficient than Singapore. But Singapore is cleaner. It's more perfect. Singapore is perfect. Everyone
has a higher penalty for throwing gum on the sidewalk.
Yes.
Well, there's different penalties. You have, you can't eat durian in public. That was one penalty.
You can't eat what?
Durian.
Oh, really?
And you can't spitting, urinating. I think the penalty for urinating in public was less than spitting for some reason. I'm not sure why, but.
Because you have to urinate, but you don't have to spit.
Wow. Huh. That was in Singapore.
Thank you.
You're talking about
Singapore.
Yeah.
Hong Kong's
lot. In Singapore, they get out and they mop the sidewalks in the morning in front of the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
They get out with a mop and soap and everything. It's amazing.
Something about chewing gum still.
Oh no, you can't even take it in the country.
Chewing gum is a big. There's a big penalty because it doesn't, actually clean itself off very well. So I'm.
Do they have trainings?
Where's the control?
See, you have to understand, Singapore is an authoritarian dictatorship. It's a benign dictator. It's very different from...
No, I just want to turn the light off so it cools off. It's the old-fashioned...
Singapore is not part of China at all.
Singapore is
it's run a lot by the Chinese.
A lot of family is originally Chinese. There's a lot of Chinese.
Everyone there speaks five languages, so it's hard to say if they're Chinese or not, there's Malays, there's Filipinos, there's Chinese, there's Indians. Those are the main populations.
There we go.
So people speak at least those five languages. So when they see me, they'll start, with the closest approximate of what they think I speak, and then they go down to this.
Export companies in Hong Kong?
Export
camera equipment?
Camera?
Yeah.
I don't know.
She's a tea expert.
Not an economist. You got me.
Growing up in Hong Kong, I was just wondering if there's a bunch of camera shops still.
Oh, there's a lot of camera shops. The only advantage of buying photographic equipment there is a sales tax. Pricing wise, it's not much better.
These are wonderful.
Yes. Thank you. So, on behalf of Many Rivers, I want to thank you so much.
You're
this
welcome.
Was wonderful.
My pleasure.
Delightful.
Yeah. Yeah. Education.
And when you tell us about where you go to get these teas, it makes such a difference when we actually drink them that we know the history and what they went through to get this.
Right.
It really makes so much difference.
Not so much what we went through, of course.